The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 191, How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa, with Leonard Arrington, Diana Gardner, Robert Kirby, Richard Ferry, and Christine Durham.
I enjoyed the panel, are stimulated by the panel, and go home thinking. I would like to open with a word of prayer. And our opening prayer will be given by David Allred. I would say because we have five panelists, we're breaking in the middle for music and at the end rather than the beginning. David?
Dear Holy God, our Creator, our Redeemer, our Lover, we are grateful for the beauty of the earth and that we have eyes to see it and can draw breath this time to enjoy friendship and companionship here. We are thankful that light is coming into the world in so many ways. Help us to walk with courage. Help us to receive the good gifts which you have to give us through our friends and directly from thy Spirit, and help us to share these things with one another, for we do need the help of one another. We are asked to do much and try to do many things. Therefore, with thy grace, bless us and bless this panel this evening that they may be able to articulate those thoughts that they have prepared, that we can communicate and be enriched thereby. In the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ, we pray, amen.
The panel tonight is entitled, How My Profession Affects My Belief and Vice Versa. Professions and religion or spirituality do play a very important role in our lives. Tonight is about how they intersect, inform, challenge, diverge, blend, and challenge, at least in the lives of our panelists. It has been said, a job done at the end of the day is a portrait of the person who did it. We have some real Rembrandts up here tonight. Truly a panel of outstanding professionals, Renaissance people, really. And I'm sure Robert Kirby objects to that because it's against his image. But I want to thank them in advance for graciously volunteering to share their lives with you. I could really lecture about each one of these for a half hour, but you want to hear them speak, so I'll make some brief introduction. The first speaker will be Leonard Arrington, of course, profession historian, father, and on his bio said the world's greatest grandfather. He received his BA from the University of Idaho, his PhD in North Carolina in economics, which is something I didn't know, taught economics at Utah State, taught at BYU history, and between 1972 and 1982 was the church historian into what I've referred to as the golden age of church history. He has written 25 books, 421 articles. I think a rather marginal contribution to the literature. And he said under pertinent information that he recently turned 80 last month. So, Diana Gardner is an artist, also a wife, a mother, a teacher, and most of what I know about her really came from her friends. And here are some quotes. She has an incredible sense of style, incredibly creative, she's clever, has a sense of humor, is very sophisticated. When I called her and quoted this to her, she said, that's all true. That's not really. And much more. Actually, I made that up. She was humble. You know, she was no less than an expert of Randall Lake, who was a fellow student, said that she was the best artist at the university. She took some time out to be a mother, and her art career has now blossomed. She's recently done a one-woman art show at Finch Lane, at the Vital Arts Gallery, and exhibits at the Springville Salon, the Utah Arts Festival, I hope you purchased, and the International Art Competition at the Church History and Art Museum. She's also an art teacher and currently works for O.C. Tanner, where she works on window displays, you know, those wonderful window displays in advertising. Robert Kirby is our only graduate on the panel of the Police Academy. However, he has arrested the four others, and since we do have a judge on the panel, we need to keep that very quiet. He did. He's a Mormon satirist, writer of a number of books, and a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune and the Daily Herald. I must tell him that his book, Wake Me for the Resurrection, actually kept me awake during several sacrament meetings. And I particularly loved him describing Mormonism's 14th article of faith. I quote, "We believe in meetings, all that have been scheduled, all that are now scheduled, and we believe that there will yet be many more great and important meetings. We have endured many meetings." By the way, that is not tonight. Tonight is not endurance. "We have endured many meetings and hope to be able to endure all meetings. If there is a meeting, we seek after it." Now, something I wasn't going to put, but he told me out in the hall that he has a new book at the printer called, you know, because he does these with Pat Bagley, "Pat and Kirby Go to Hell." And what I thought was interesting is they actually, I thought he was joking, but this is true, there are printing stickers that say "heck" to put over the word "hell" so they can sell it at Deseret Books. What a culture. And he's married, has three daughters. And on his bio, under his association organizations, he said he belonged to the War in Heaven Conscientious Objectors. And under pertinent information, he's nearsighted. After that, because that's three illuminating speakers, we will have a rest song. And that is in your program, so you can follow along. And we will sing God Reigns O'er All the Earth. And the piano player, accompanist, will be Tim Archer. And I'm taking the chair to ask Ardeen Watts because he's really a boring director. And so he will liven us up by directing. Then our last two speakers, the next one will be Richard Ferry. He's a child psychiatrist. Now, Rich has been a long, close friend of mine, so frankly, I question his professional judgment. One thing he did tell me is he cares more about advocacy in many ways than professionalism. And what he means by that, and knowing Rich as well as I do, I believe this is very true, is that he sees psychiatry about advocacy for those that don't have advocates, and he is an advocate. He's the chairman of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Primary Children, and the amazing thing is he still loves children. He's the associate clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Medical School. He received his degrees at Stanford, at the University of Utah. He's also a father and husband. Our last speaker will be Christine Durham, who was the first woman, I believe, on the Utah Supreme Court, not before the Supreme Court, on it, since 1982. I also count her as a long-term close friend, so therefore I question her judicial judgment. Prior to that, she was a trial judge, and prior to that, a practicing attorney. When I asked her what to say, she said, "Well, I'm a judge, a mother, a grandmother, a church worker, a community volunteer. I have too many things to do, I'm too busy, but I'm enjoying them. She's very active in judicial education. She's the past president of the National Association of Women Judges, and of course she serves on numerous national, local committees and organizations. That's quite a panel. After that, we'll have questions or darts from the audience and comments from the distinguished panel. Then we will close with a song, Now the Day is Over, by the same dynamic duo that presented at halftime. And then our closing prayer will be given by Bernard Silva. Thanks again for your attendance, and thank you, panelists. We're looking forward to it.
A personal request first. If anybody here knows someone by the name of Stephanie Kerr, tell me how I might get in touch with her. Throughout most of my life, I have had an intimate connection between history and religion and the church. My studies in history bolstered my faith and my religion, and the church encouraged me in the study of history, and nothing but honest history was worth doing. My connection with history began in 1929 when I was 12 years old, when our ward decided to organize a junior genealogical class for Sunday school, and the bishop called me to attend that class instead of my regular Sunday school class. The first week, we were asked to write our personal biographies and autobiographies, and I wrote my history up to the age 12, and it's typed out at about 13 pages. I still have it. The second week, I was asked to write the history of my father. The third week, my mother. The fourth week, to write about faith-promoting experiences in my life, and so on throughout the year. It was very exciting for me. I enjoyed very much the reading of these little essays, which I still have. Unfortunately, after that first year, the committee were so excited about the class and what it had done that they sent a report of it to the head of the Sunday school in Salt Lake City. He decided we had departed from the plan and that we should drop it immediately, which they did. But in any case, there were some of us who finished the program who were excited and thrilled and have ever since been interested in family and church history. When I was taking vocational agriculture in the high school, I was a farm boy and member of the FFA, they encouraged us to prepare talks to give on agriculture. I was very interested, read a great deal of agricultural history, did give talks on the subject, and learned something about research in history. When I was 16, a woman to whom I had been a home teacher gave me a copy of Joseph Smith, an American Prophet by John Henry Evans. It had just been published. I read it, was very excited about it, thought it was a wonderful biography and very interesting. I've read it many times since. I am very grateful to have been introduced to Joseph Smith by that biography, which, in my mind, presents Joseph Smith in his true role. When I went to the University of Idaho, being interested in religion, I took all of the classes taught by the director of the Institute of Religion, George Tanner. He was one of the graduates of the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He'd got his degree in Christian history and the relationship of Mormon history to that. I had a chance to get from him a good introduction to the history of Joseph Smith, of the church by Joseph Smith, and the 6-volume comprehensive history of the church by B.H. Roberts. When I went to the University of North Carolina to do graduate work, I read widely in economics and sociology and historical works. There was no other Mormon in Chapel Hill or at the university, either as teacher or student or community resident. And so I spent a great deal of time reading about religion. And I was surprised to discover there was in existence a scholarly literature about Mormonism and its culture. Works by Lowry Nelson, T. Lynn Smith, Bernard DeVoto, Juanita Brooks, and others, especially writers in the field of rural sociology, always had a little section or chapter on the Mormons, the Mormon village, and Mormon culture. At that time, in reading those, I conceived the idea of doing myself a book on Mormon social and economic contributions to the development of the West. Then along came World War II. I was drafted into the Army. I spent 3 years in North Africa and Italy, and during those 3 years, never saw a Mormon, never heard of a Mormon meeting. So I was completely away from church associations. But through books sent to me by my wife and my mother, I was able to keep up reading about books that dealt with Mormonism and Western history. I decided while I was overseas that I wanted to do a doctor's dissertation on the contribution of the Mormons to the economic development of the West. And so when I returned to Chapel Hill after the end of World War II, I applied for jobs in Western schools and was offered the best job at Utah State Agricultural College in Logan, where I became a professor of economics. Each summer, beginning in July 1946, each summer I came to Salt Lake City, rented a room, and studied in what used to be called the Old Church Historian's Office. And I did that for a period of 5 summers and read through, word for word, all of the Journal History of the Church, 800 volumes, that had gone from the period 1847 to 1900. During the regular school year, while teaching classes in economics, I worked over those notes, and by the time of 1950, I had prepared a number of articles for publication in economics and sociological and historical journals, and so my experience in publishing began at that time. There were 3 other professors at Utah State who had similar interests: George Ellsworth, Gene Campbell, and Wendell Rich. And we used to meet each month at different homes and read papers that we had written about aspects of Mormon and Western history. In this way, we became acquainted also with others who were doing the same thing at BYU: Jim Allen and Davis Bitton and Dick Paul, Gus Larson, Fred Buchanan, and others. Ultimately, of course, we formed an organization, the Mormon History Association, which made it possible on a wide basis for the giving of papers and research on Mormon history. Meantime, I continued to be active in the church in Logan and became a member of the High Council and then of the stake presidency of the University of Stake, University Stake that was set up there. Along came Dialogue, in which we participated, and Sunstone, and other publications of that nature, all of which we encouraged and participated in. Then in 1972, as he mentioned, I was asked by President Tanner to serve as the church historian to replace Elder Howard Hunter, who is an attorney and who did not think it appropriate for the church historian to be an attorney. And so they asked me as a professional historian to take over the old church historian's office, organize the historical department of the church, and to begin research, writing, and publishing church history as the revelations require that it be done. In this effort, they gave us an adequate budget to employ a dozen young historians to help in the work of research, writing, and publishing, and some of them are still engaged in doing so. We were supported all along by President Eldon Tanner, by President Harold B. Lee, and by President Spencer Kimball. And we had a total of 10 years of marvelous research and publication. We published, during our 10-year period, roughly 34 books and published roughly 400 articles in professional magazines and in The Ensign, New Era, and other publications, BYU Studies, Dialogue, Sunstone, other publications of that nature. All of our historians deepened and strengthened their testimonies of the gospel as a result of using the documents in the archives of the church. We were not prevented from using them. We were not discouraged from making historical surveys and publishing materials. And many of them became, while they were working, became bishops, Relief Society presidents, even stake presidents, even mission presidents, even a temple president out of our little group of historians. Basically, I'm glad to say that my studies in history have bolstered my faith, and that I have felt that my church, my religion, have encouraged me in continuing my studies of good, honest history. Thank you.
Still wondering where he got that information in my introduction. I'm pleased to be here tonight, and I'm talking about my favorite subject in the world, and that is how spirituality affects my profession. In the beginning, can you hear? That's better? Okay. As I began my search in the art field, there were several questions that occurred to me, and one of the first ones was, Can I paint? Should I be in this profession? Do I have the skills and the mastery of the language so that I can accomplish and put down the idea? But the scariest question of all is, do I have anything to say? Do I have anything significant to say or to tell anyone about? Let me just talk about art as a language for a second. Many of you, I'm sure, feel very intimidated when you go into an art gallery or some kind of an art show. And I was one of those as well. Even when I had my education at the university and had my bachelor's degree, often the artwork would still very much intimidate me because I knew there was something underneath the surface that I didn't understand. Just like poetry and how we combine words to make our verses, the principles and the language of art are tied up in color and value, in line and texture, scale and proportion, rhythm, balance, emphasis. So if I were to take away from you your tools of writing and ask you to express yourself with those, with that language, it might be a little more difficult for you to do. My quest at this point was, how do I get my art to speak? Because I spent many years in school trying to perfect those very things I just talked about, but I wanted my art to speak. Who am I anyway that I might have something that I could say that is profound? I'm a housewife. I'm a mother. I'm raising children. There's nothing extraordinary about myself. I'm doing what millions of other people are doing. And it was a little bit discouraging to me as I pursued my art career because so much of what I was doing seemed to fall short of speaking from my soul. Therefore, if I was something rather mundane and ordinary, my thesis became making the ordinary extraordinary rather than making the extraordinary ordinary. I would venture to say that I was probably better at making the extraordinary ordinary. There's a scripture in Moses 6, verse 63, and it reads, "And behold, all things have their likeness, and all things are created and made to bear record of me, both things which are temporal and things which are spiritual, things are in the heavens above and things which are on the earth, and things which are in the earth, and things which are under the earth, both above and beneath, all things bear record of me." Of course, I've heard many interpretations of that scripture, but as an artist, it became my thesis once again. And I understood that all things bear record of our Savior. I want to take a minute and just show some slides. I hope that I don't take up too much time doing this, but somebody can hit the lights, and I probably will need to speak from down there. I don't know if the remote will work from this far or not. We'll try it. Okay, this is a piece that was very typical of my work before I began the soul search. And you can see at this point, I technically have the skills, very much so. In fact, probably too skilled. I can do a straight line without using a ruler and stay within that line. But like I said, this work started to fall short for me because it seemed so literal, and it didn't really feel like it spoke from the soul. Let's see if I can see what this is doing. My foundation, of course, was in portraiture, and Randall Lake and I were in many of the same classes. And that, by the way, he was the greatest, is the greatest artist from the University Art Department. And these things were satisfying, but they also were very much about representation and not capturing what was going on inside of me. However, it was a challenge to try and capture the likeness of the person and also the spirit of the person that I was trying to paint. So how do I take the challenge of going from this type of painting and ending up with this type? And that first one, I should go back and let you see this. This is a self-portrait, once when I had long hair, to this as my self-portrait. And the next, and this as my self-portrait. Now, I'll go through these kind of quickly so that we can get through them. But you can see there was a huge step taken between the two. And the process began by taking away from myself all of the tools that I was familiar with because I had mastered them so well. And I put myself in a studio without any of my old tools, and I was forced to go by faith and create. And these are the sizes that some of these pieces, most of the pieces that you'll be seeing, are 6 feet by 6 feet. This is called Bride and Groom. My self-portrait. This is a sink stopper. And that this one is, let me go back. This piece here is actually 8 inches by 8 inches. And I used magazines to cut up with because I didn't have paintbrushes or paints, pencils. I had to create a new form of expression here. From there, I thought I'd go into painting and take those little sketches and make them paintings. But for some reason, the papers themselves became more interesting to me. And this is a 6 foot by 6 foot, and I call this the, now I'm losing it. What is it? Yeah, it's a sink stopper, but there's a metaphor. It'll come to me. That's it's a little larger than life, but you can see all the pieces that are layered there. This is Fred and Ethel. Somehow still relates to me. This one is called Sisters. My Sea of Despair. There's a story behind all of these. The Big Sweep. Notice the materials I'm using. I'm finding things in my ordinary life, like wallpaper, grocery labels, and newspaper articles, garbage, basically, and recycling the garbage to try and make something out of them. This one is Hell's Kitchen. And if you look, they're difficult to read up close. As you get distance on them, you can see them better, but I can hide all kinds of messages in there, which I have done. My Everest. turning it over. Solo. Many people get me confused with Andy Warhol. And this one is one of the most significant, and I'll stay here for just a minute because I want to explain something. This is an 8x8 cheese grater, 8 inch by 8 inch, and enlarged to 6 feet by 6 feet. And at this point, I'd just like to talk to you a little bit about the content behind these pieces. As I was working, it became sort of like an onion in peeling its layers back. And the obvious image was clear to most of you who view them. But as you look at them, to me, there were several more layers of meaning that occurred in the process of developing this style. And the second layer would be a metaphor for maybe shedding our skin and getting to the core of who we are. And then the third is spoken of in the scriptures of the keeper of the gate. And I won't read that scripture to you right now. You're mostly familiar with it. But if we were to apply that scripture to this piece, there are so many meanings that could be brought to it. And just to share a secret with you so that you understand that artists often will have their own mythology behind their work, I came to understand as I was working on this piece that the gatekeeper could represent Christ and his atoning sacrifice for us. But not only that each one of us have to pass through that gate and pay a toll in order for us to find out who we are and shed our sin or our pain, and that's how we get to who we are. I may not have a lot of time to go into depth, but I just want to show you quickly a little bit of the process and how I got to this point. This is what I deal with every day. And this is a portrait of Fred and Ethel. Okay, I own it. It's my mess. I threw this in here because I was very discouraged at one point, thinking, how on earth am I ever going to put my life on canvas? So this is what I came up with. Now, this is Mondrian, mind you. And this is what I got. I started saving garbage, and people started bringing me their garbage. I started valuing labels, and I got very angry at grocery stores or at companies that would change their labels. This was my family room. These were my cupboards. Had no clue what was in those cans. Made life interesting. Now I'm struggling here with, when I talked about the vocabulary, I'm struggling to try and get the color to work with all these crazy pieces. Now I know why I don't like to go to the grocery store, because nothing subordinates to each other. No paints, you can see. This is a short process of thinking. I could go from a photograph. The middle one is from paper, and then the bottom one is paint. It's a little blurry there. And then that's a large one. I'm thinking somehow I ought to be able to incorporate these grocery labels into my happy family life. And so that's just a short synopsis of the process. This is called My Sunday's Duet, and I'll end it with that. And I just have one more quote that I would like to tell you, and that is, you can turn the light on. That's fine. This is a quote from Thomas More, in Soulmates. The soul finds its home in the ordinary details of everyday life and does not in itself have an urgent need for understanding and achievement. And this has been so true because these pieces not only had meaning for me at the time, but continue to unfold meanings and that become more and more profound.
Since no one has done it already, I thought it would be important if we recognize President Boyd K. Packer on the very back row. You'd be surprised how many of you turned around. I divide my life up into, or my most recent part of my life anyway, up into two segments. The first, when I was a police officer for 11 years here in Utah, and then after I left police work and became a writer. Yep. Hello? Okay, do I have to be really close, like this? Does it work now? Okay.
Just don't move.
Anyway, I became a police officer in 1978 and worked for a year and a half in Tooele County and then moved to Utah County, which is kind of the bastion of Mormondom in Utah, or I call it the Tehran of Utah. I got into police work. I was very active in the church, a returned missionary, and it was kind of an interesting baptism into the Mormon culture, because you see the other side of it quite a bit. You see what Mormons are capable of. And there was a time when I thought, well, I could bring my priesthood and my faith and my religion to police work and actually serve people better. But it wasn't too long as a police officer in Utah working primarily with Mormons that I realized that Mormons really needed a police officer with the priesthood less than they needed a policeman who would punch them. And I gradually grew bitter as I saw Mormons doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And it left me eventually with the question, if the church really was true, how come so many of us are still stupid? And I had a hard time coping with that, and I became very bitter. And it wasn't until I had a couple of experiences that made me realize that that was the primary purpose of life, is that all of the pageantry in human existence is found directly in the area that lies between the way we want things to be and the way that they really are. And that's what God is trying to teach us down here. And when I finally figured that out for myself, I started to write. And I wrote a lot of really bad stuff first. But writing was kind of it brought me out of this dark period in my life where I ended up as a police officer, where it didn't trouble me at all to break somebody's bones. That's a pretty terrible thing to say, but it's also true. And I knew that it was very bad for me to be there. And I started to write, and I found out that I wanted to really write about what I had just gone through being a police officer, but I didn't want to really stick with police work in doing it. So I fixed myself on the culture and started writing specifically about the culture. And I did that actually by accident. I wrote a piece called Five Kinds of Mormons and published it in the Utah County Journal. I was a writer for them and a columnist. And when it came out, the publisher was really angry about that. He was absolutely positive that we would receive all these horrible letters telling us that we had done, you know, offended all of our readers. And we did get a lot of letters. He wrote the first one. I always liked that. And we got a bunch of letters in response, nearly all of them telling him that he was an idiot for getting so upset about that. And I realized that Mormons really need this cathartic experience of being able to laugh about ourselves. It's different. I mean, some of us are arrogant enough to believe that laughing about ourselves is the same thing as laughing about God or laughing at God. But it's not true. It really isn't. And as I wrote about this stuff, the irony continued to occur to me in greater and greater strength. And weird things would occur to me while I was sitting in church, namely that maybe the reason why we have all these morons in this culture is because we've had centuries of brothers marrying sisters. Obviously, these aren't the kinds of things that you want to bring up in Sunday school, but they are. I mean, there's some factual basis to it. And it was really, and it actually changed my position in the church, because as I'd go to Sunday school before and sit in the back of Sunday school and wonder, let's see, I arrested him, I arrested her, I knocked her down at a family fight, oh, I broke his arm. After that, I would start to make these observations in church, and it was a little bit disconcerting to some of the people in there to have them bring up something about brothers and sisters marrying each other. But then I started writing in the Salt Lake Tribune, and I hadn't changed so much as the church started to change around me. If you can picture yourself in the Spring Creek 8th Ward, and you're just itching to say something that might be really stupid, people in the Spring Creek 8th Ward don't say it as much as they used to. Because if you get up in my Sunday school and say it, I might make you famous on Saturday. And so whenever something even even marginally comes close to the edge, everybody will kind of look and see how Brother Kirby's taking it. Or if I start, like, writing a note, people will sit down real fast. But this sense of irony, and I had to learn it as a police officer in order to be able to do it when it came to writing. But this sense of irony and this appreciation for irony has actually made me a better person today. Had you known me 10 years ago, you wouldn't be laughing. But this experience, or the transition that I've gone through in being able to express myself within the culture, writing about my own family, as it were, has been very beneficial for me, because I've gotten rid of a lot of the animosity that I had about the church before. It's easy to sit down and read some of the things that we read about our culture today or about the doings of our ancestors that can leave a sour taste in our mouth or make us bitter. And that's dangerous to do, because what happens to you then is the same thing that happened to me while I was a police officer, is you start carrying around this load of anger, this axe, and you're just itching to use it on somebody. You got to find a way to turn that around so that you can use it in a positive way. So even if it isn't necessarily beneficial to everybody else, it makes you feel better. Because if not, it'll just eat you up. Lately, it's gotten actually a little bit better for me, in that I've started to get feedback from people who actually recognize me from my picture in the Tribune, which is sort of an insult. People come up and say, oh, I recognize you from your picture in the paper, and you just kind of want to slap them. Because it's a horrible picture, and I want you to all agree with me, because I don't want anybody saying that it does look like me. They'll tell me stories about the culture, and basically what it comes down to is, if Mormons had been able to be a little bit more self-deprecating in the view of themselves, that they wouldn't have become as bitter as they are. I had one lady come up to me on the street one day, don't know who she was, who actually cried on my chest, which was amazing, and say that if there had been Mormons like you doing what you're doing 10 years ago, my husband would have still been a member of the church when he died. That's a terrible thing to say about our culture, that we have this difficult time taking ourselves not quite so seriously. And it isn't that we take ourselves seriously, it's that we honestly believe that God does. And And that to me is the height of arrogance. Yes, ma'am. We believe that God takes us seriously.
I'm sorry, am I not speaking into the mic?
But it, as I said, it has improved my view of the church and my view of my own place in it that I can do this. Now, a lot of people say, well, sooner or later you're going to run afoul of the general authorities or things are going to happen and you're going to upset them. Those things have already happened. I've talked to general authorities about what I do, and the conversations have been very friendly, very amiable. They haven't told me to shut up. They've expressed what concerns they have. I wrote a column once where I said I could beat up President Hinckley. I can, because he's old. And he's a prophet, so there's no way God would let him sucker punch me. But it apparently offended some of the people in the church, and it always seems to anger mid-level management more than it does anywhere else in the church. And so I got this call, and we talked about it, and he said, you know, I believe that you've gone too far because you've reduced the prophet to the level of a roustabout. And I said, well, I'm just trying to personalize somebody who views themselves as a very common sort of a person. And I apologize and said I'll try to be a little bit more careful or more circumspect in the future. And it wasn't just President Hinckley. I said I could beat up the Pope. And that Mother Teresa probably couldn't take a punch. Billy Graham, I mean, he's getting on in years. And the whole column was about why I'm not afraid of church leaders. And so I thought, well, if I've offended this particular individual, and never once did our conversation become acrimonious, I thought, well, I better write a letter. And so I wrote a letter to President Hinckley, and I said, I'm sorry that if I've, you know, offended you in any way. I was just trying to paint you as a very approachable person. I'll try to be a little more careful in the future. P.S., I think I could still beat up the Pope. And I didn't say that I wanted to. I just said that I could. Push came to shove. And I thought that would be the end of it, you know, that I would be careful about how I talked about the prophet in the future. But this letter comes back from President Hinckley's office. And this is all true, by the way. I make some stuff up, but not this. Some stuff, little stuff. Back comes this letter from President Hinckley's office saying that, you know, we're not offended. Don't sweat it. Have fun. Good luck. Which is really encouraging to me. It's very refreshing to see that on the part of church leaders. Not because it says something about them, but it gives us, the rest of us, permission to be the sorts of people I think that our Heavenly Father would have us be. And that is just a little bit less stiff in the neck. We really need to be that way. And that includes Mormons of all faiths. No matter which direction you're traveling. You got to learn to laugh about who you are and what you are and what you're about, because there's always a possibility that you could be wrong, no matter where you are on a particular question. I appreciate the time tonight. Thank you.
I'm not so sure. I wouldn't rather have my bones broken than have our friend Kirby stand up in the meeting and tell me that I'm stupid. I think President Hinckley would be just as happy to have his bones broken than necessarily be on your page in the Tribune. Well, I'm going to stand down here because I don't like pulpits much. And I think it might be a little bit easier for me to talk a little bit to you this way. I've been reflecting and feeling a lot about what to say tonight. Probably written 10 talks in the time that I've had to think about it, in trying to tie the threads of my professional life and my religious life and how those are interwoven and what makes what and how do the different colors of both relate to each other. And for me, there has been truly an integration along the way between my spiritual and my professional life, my life and my mind, in the way those two have intertwined themselves over the years. A kind of a strand that intertwines together, then woven to such a cloth that as it's wrapped around me and gives me a sense of comfort, I'm more impressed by the patterns it's made than the threads themselves, knowing not sure where they actually came from. But just as a guess as to maybe where some of those threads came from, I just had to think for a second. If you look at one side of the gospel side, shall we say, the spiritual side or the professional side, was it free agency and the counsel in heaven, or was it the power of will as the product of psychological force that grew out of enmeshment that actually defines the fact that man has a unique consciousness of self? Was it the glory of God as intelligence as a principle, or was it the fact that the ego is freed from irrationality when you can let go of perceptual distortion enough and your past experience to be able to see the relevant in the present so that man can really act rationally? Or was it the concept of eternal progression, or was it the development that I see in the lives of people that enlightens my sense that there is continued growth from now and forever? Or was it the whisperings of the Holy Ghost or the Spirit that gave me a sense, or was it the awakening that occurs in the unconscious process of the mind that said that there really is power in the intuitive mind? Or was it perhaps the fact that Christ's parables, I love them all the times that I read them, or was it really the fact that as I sat at the feet of someone who told me of their own metaphors, that I really took pleasure in understanding that there is light and understanding in the human mind when they understand their own story? Was it a broken heart and a contrite spirit, or was it the therapeutic experience of someone giving up defenses and their resistances and accepting the truth about themselves that brought about real change? Was it Jesus Christ that said, "Love everyone, and I would die for you and give my life for you"? Or was it the understanding that true joy comes from the capacity to be able to share intimate experience with one another in relationships? How do all those things interact, and what made what? Well, those threads have woven themselves so tightly that I'm not sure which gives me the greater understanding and the greater truth. The gospel for me is a little different than the church, okay? And that has to do with the principles of things like love and humility and sacrifice and the ability to sense the common humanness in all of us and the need for humility in order to be teachable. Those sort of principles that sometimes get lost in the church concept of how we try to pull that together as an institution. The other side is the science of the mind and the emotional brain, which I've spent years experiencing and learning and trying to somehow grasp how it is that all these factors work together: the biology, the genetics, the development, the past experience, the unconscious, and how those intuitive forces in an abstract way give the mind reason and understanding and allow us to feel the way we do. It seems that as I've gone through my life, one pulls one direction and the other pulls the other. And the more I try to understand one side, I'll always see something coming from the other. And it's almost like gravity. It keeps pulling them each together. And let me just give you a couple of examples. First of all is the science of the mind and the science of psychology is more focused on process than content. It's process that really helps us understand what actually goes on in the decision-making process. what is unconscious to us often is not what we say a bicycle is, but what we do when we're on the bicycle and how that all happens without us even thinking about it, that takes us in a certain direction. And our lives are a lot more about process, as I've understood it, from these experiences than it is about content. And too often, in my experience with the church, it's about what is right and wrong. What is right and wrong? What is the principle? Who was this person and what was this content? And in my experience with people, it's more about process. It's about the psychological process, the underpinnings, the biology of what it is we all experience and how that interacts to create something. And so consequently, it changes your perception of what really counts and what really matters. For example, there was a young man who in his early life had a great deal of sensitivity. He also had in his life a father who was terribly critical. The combination of his sensitivity, which biologically was based, and he had a high anxiety disorder, and the capacity he had to sense with his intelligent mind how things were in his world, ran strictly against the way his father treated him in the sense of only valuing competitively his accomplishments rather than his sensitivity. And over time, as this developed, he became less and less secure within himself because he perceived a world that was not reinforced by his experience. Well, he went on a mission, and this is a very brief story about a young man with an incredible sensitivity. And when he got on his mission, he went out reaching again to discover the sensitivity in the capacity that he had to make relationships with people that were there. And every time he turned around, he was confronted with the content of not enough baptisms. And he kept then re-experiencing his father in the mission president, although he couldn't really articulate it. And pretty soon, the content of baptisms and the content of never being good enough and the content of saying it's never going to be enough, he decided that God was not there. And that God was not in his home, and God was not in his church, and God was not in his life. And so he left the church. He became inactive. And if you look at the content of his life outside the doors of a Mormon church, you could very quickly maybe make a judgment about what was wrong in his way of dealing with things. But it was only in experiencing this young man from the day he started feeling the pain of his own sensitivity, being locked in part into the biology of a brain that said you will feel things more acutely than others, and your anxiety will make you want to be careful about everyone you meet, and you will want to find what's right about other people as to whether or not it necessarily matters who wins. And every time I meet him, it's a spiritual experience. And somehow the process has changed how I see the young man, as opposed to whether or not the content tells me he is not being true. Another example is my own experience in continually trying to grow out of enmeshment. The process of growing out of enmeshment is trying to somehow get beyond your own biology and your own psychology and your own past experience to somehow see life for what it really truly is. We will always be somehow blocked by the temporal state at deciding who we really are. And spirituality will always be somehow tempered by the temporal state. Just what you said, Professor and Bishop and Prophet Kirby. That is, you do have a course in this, I hope. And that is going from the possible and what we think is the ideal and what we actually live. As I keep refining this, the other day I was experiencing a great deal of pain. Somehow, in the process of my life, trying to understand what it means to love someone, since that's what kept pulling me back toward the gospel, was the principle of love, and saying, that really takes precedence over everything, science and everything. I said, how do you love and continue to love in a way that really makes sense? And I found that the more I loved, the more I suffered. And the more I cared, the more there was grieving. And that seemed to happen because You see the pain that people have, and you see that so much of what you care about in that individual, you can't change. But I was talking with a friend who said to me, what is this thing about your grieving? It seems to me that you've decided that love must always carry pain, and there's something that you still carry with you every time that says that that pain must therefore have always be as part of your loving. Is it something you just brought with you from the past, and can't you let it go? Now, there's no way in the church I could somehow understand what he was saying if I hadn't had this other experience. And somehow it spoke to a part of me that I didn't really quite understand, but I know intuitively is part of something that says I can do more than live with my past. And there I was talking to a young man who was so close to his mother that when she left him, he went into deep despair, and he felt abandoned. And when he told me of how, of all experiences that he'd had, and he was able to make a connection with me and said in so many words that he could sense that I loved him and I loved him too, when it got to the time for him to leave me, I remember how painful it was for him to get angry and said, "You've abandoned me because you're telling me I have to leave you." And as I was talking to him and saying, "No, I know that you can do this. My love is sufficient to tell you that it's all right for you to grow beyond me. I was there for you at a time, and though I loved you, the love must not stop you from growing, and I must let you go." And he said, "That's because you really don't love me." And his anger allowed him to move away, and he left. And as I watched him left, I felt the same grief again, and I realized that I was grieving for the intimacy of my own childhood that I had to leave behind as he was leaving me, and that somehow I had finally come around again to understand the process that had gotten me where I was, and I could take another step forward. On the other hand, the spiritual side, what if when he told me, the same young man, that as he was grieving about this and was out making all kinds of errors in his life, his grandfather came to him one night and stood before him and said, "As I loved you when you were three, and I told you that I would be leaving you, even so I am back in your life." And he looked at the young man and he said, "You must change. You must turn around and go in another direction." And as that young man said in my office, it was not like I had experienced with other psychiatric situations. It was not something that I would normally say, "Oh, right, that's a hallucination." I was sitting there and I felt the same thing, and I said, "Your grandfather has called you back." And he started to cry, and we both experienced the same thing. One more point. Psychiatry is also about development. And the one thing that seems real clear to me is that if one stays enmeshed in a certain place in one's development, there comes a point that limits you in your capacity to express agency. And one of those is that transition through adolescence when we finally have to sort of let go of the authority figure and say, "There's a piece in me that I must develop to guide my own vision for my life." And sometimes what happens, it seems to me, that as I would go beyond struggling with the fact that I would like to have some more space in my life, but at the same time I wished that someone would just call me as a regional representative. I realized that I was waiting for the church to call me to my own life, and that sometimes if you were really going to move through that adolescent development, we can't wait for a bishop or a stake president or some other authority to decide who it is we need to be, and we can't wait for the church to become what it needs to be for us and for us to be okay. And if it weren't for the capacity to see that at some point as an adolescent I had to move on, and that the true spirit was that it must whisper within me to tell me who my divine soul is in order for me to have the vision for my own life, and that at some point, as Nephi, I have to cut off Laban's head and say, "It is me that makes this decision, and it is I who will live with the responsibility for my choices, and those choices may bring me into disrepute or in some degree wrong with what somebody else might think, but in the soul of my heart, it is me who must make that decision, and I must do it for myself," and not be afraid of the divine light that is within us to see that for ourselves. One more thing, sorry, and that is that as I sit there, therefore, at the seat of those who have the heart to feel their own pain and their own suffering, and I see within them that light of the Spirit,
it seems that I have come to another place at where both sides pull the science and the gospel, the mind and the knowledge and the spirit of love, and have come to understand that when those forces that allow you to really truly see the truth of another person, there is something that happens that has allowed me to see that love and truth are the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. That if you truly love someone, you will know the truth of who they are. And if you truly know who they are, you cannot help but love them. And as I feel in that same spiritual moment, I've suddenly realized that at that same moment that I know truth, I also know love. And when I know love, I know truth. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I be heard? Good. I'd like to stay here, if I may, and finish at least the formal remarks of the evening in a more conversational setting. I'm under strict instructions from my colleague here to speak to you in tongues. Specifically, non-lawyer speak. This from a former member of a profession which gives testimony in court about canine units exiting police vehicles instead of dogs jumping out of cars. I actually really appreciate the injunction, and I hope I can be responsive to it. If I might take just a moment to focus on this question of tongues or of language, it strikes me that we have had a remarkable experience this evening of listening to a remarkable group of people speak to us in their own languages about the spiritual experiences that they have had. We've heard about someone who has worked throughout a long life in the language of history and faith, about someone who works with the language of color, line, shape, values, someone who speaks the language of laughter and the language of the humility that can come from gentle self-deprecation. And we've heard a little from someone who spends a great deal of time speaking the language of psychological process and of human suffering. In wondering a little bit about what I might bring to that discussion, I realize that in some respects, one of the languages that I have always spoken in terms of my spiritual life, or at least tried to speak, is the language of philosophy. But I'll be careful here, Robert. When I was in college, the spiritual journey on which I found myself engaged drew me to the more intellectual pursuits around religious subjects. In fact, I ended up concentrating in my college studies on religion and philosophy, and even wrote a thesis about Kierkegaard, which I made my poor husband-to-be type. The fact that he's forgiven me for that is a good explanation of why we've stayed married all these years. I even thought after college about going to divinity school, but I couldn't figure out what the world was going to do with a female Mormon preacher. So I opted for the secular priesthood and became a lawyer. Some of my friends think that was a very poor second choice. I do think there is considerable overlap, however, in some of the professional interests which I have and the things which inform my enjoyment of the law as a profession, and particularly in my second profession of being a judge. There are a lot of parallels, by the way, between theology and jurisprudence. Each discipline has its own vocabulary. There are a lot of very strict rules. Each system has to deal with the unavailability in any empirical, demonstrable way of ultimate truth. There are operational power systems. As a woman, I don't function in the priesthood for purposes, for example, of binding seals on the earth, but as a judge, I can perform marriage ceremonies. And it is by virtue of the authority vested in me by the state that those marriages become legal and are recognized by the state. So I have I've had some exposure in my professional life to the ways in which those systems of authority operate. We even have scriptures, you understand, in the law. They're known as constitutions or statutes, and judges get to be the prophets who interpret those. The parallels aren't really what I want to talk about tonight, though, although it's interesting, I think, to see that they are there. I wanted to make a couple of comments about themes that emerged as I've undergone the same process that our other speakers have here tonight, of trying to understand ways in which my religious and personal belief systems intersect with my professional and public life. One thing I do want to say at the outset on that theme is that in the legal system in which we operate in the United States of America, one of the primary tenets, and it is a part, in fact, the first part of the Bill of Rights appended to our Constitution, is the existence of a strict separation between church and state. In addition to that, I operate in the context of a professional ideal which requires impartiality and, insofar as is humanly possible, a complete absence of bias. Well, if you define bias as merely an orientation to the world, and those of you who have ever cut out a piece of fabric on the bias, you understand that, literally speaking, bias only denotes direction. It doesn't necessarily have a pejorative content. But in the context of judging, bias is not regarded as a good thing. And one of the things that is very important for judges who aspire to the ideal of impartiality is to identify their own orientations in the world and to try to distance themselves from them to the extent that they can become fair, open-minded decision makers. And one of the things I want to make very clear is that I think it is possible to do that through a level of self-awareness. For example, I do not regard it as impossible or improper for me to sit in judgment on secular issues involving, say, civil liability, involving the institution of my church, any more than I would regard it as improper or impossible to judge those same issues of civil liability involving someone else's church, because I don't think I'm biased in favor of the outcome. At the same time, I realize that, as is true of all of us, my values come from the things that are most truly a part of my core and my identity. I tried to make a little list for purposes of tonight's comments of the things that I believe that affect the way I live my life. I think there's a difference between a creed, which simply represents an abstract commitment of mind, and a set of beliefs or values that make a difference in the way you act at any given point in time, or at least in the way you aspire to act. I very much liked your comments, Robert, about the fact that the most wonderful things about human beings take place in that gap between the way the world is and the way we'd like the world to be. And in fact, that relates to the first thing I put on my list. I believe that human beings grow. And Richard Ferry talked about the concept of development. I think that individual lives and human institutions are developmental. Now, how is that tied to my belief system? I think it has something to do with the commitment, the very radical commitment, we embrace in Mormonism to the notion of perfectibility. We put a little too much emphasis sometimes, perhaps, on the perfect end of the spectrum, but the concept that we aspire, that we entertain the notion that human beings and human institutions are perfectible, does an enormous amount to affect the way we relate to our families, to our neighbors, to the institutions we work in, to our jobs. I think it is remarkable for whatever peculiarities we still enjoy in the latter part of the 20th century in Christendom. I also believe that human beings have inherent worth and that they deserve respect and dignity, for they are God's children. Connected to that belief is my conviction that public institutions, as well as private ones, should function accordingly. My own relationship with the sacred is intensely personal. It's quite private, and in fact, in preparing for this, I've decided it's very difficult, if not impossible, to articulate in public and non-intimate settings. But it does define who I think I am and who I think other people are. There's a wonderful little airport book. You've heard of Refrigerator Thoughts from Relief Society. Well, I'm getting a collection of airport books these days. But it's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and it's all small stuff. There's a little essay in there about looking at other people and imagining that they are newborn babies or 100-year-old humans. You can't look into somebody's face and think of them as a baby, as an infant, or as a very old and frail person without shifting your orientation to that person. That's something that I try to do in an abstract way in the work I do. A lot of the work I do is very abstract, but also in a personal way as I work with very difficult issues involving the courts and society and crime and the abuses that we inflict on each other. Like Robert, you can get pretty cynical and discouraged about the wideness of the gap, and it helps sometimes to reduce ourselves to our lowest common denominator, which I think is what happens when we think of each other as infants in need. An important function of my belief system is to encourage me to take the long view while making the existential effort on a day-to-day basis to improve the here and now. It would be easier for all of us to give up on the institutions which are meaningful to us. There are a great many people who do give up on many institutions, on public institutions, on civic institutions. There are people, as Robert was describing, who give up on the church because of the discouragement they experience over institutional obstacles. My belief system allows me to continue to tolerate the obstacles, to try to find ways around them, to look for opportunities to see how my own development is coming. I think that transcendence, the ability to get beyond ourselves, it operates, first of all, in many directions. We often think of transcendence in terms of art or poetry or beauty or truth. I think it's very useful to think of transcendence in terms of laughter and poking fun and deprecating our own foibles. But in whatever direction that kind of transcendence travels, I think it makes life better. It makes life more bearable. It makes it much more rich and more beautiful. Religious belief is a source of transcendence in my life, and I think my life is richer for it. Let me end with two verses from Isaiah 55. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. I don't think in this life many of us will approach the thoughts and ways of God, but I think it's very important that we keep on trying. Thank you.
If we could have the panelists come back up. And I'd like to open it up. Again, I would like to thank the panel members for their openness to discuss how their lives intersect from different perspectives with religion and professionally. So any comments, questions? And if there is a mic up here, if you'd like to use it. If not, I need to repeat the question for the tape. So turn over to the audience. The question was, or do you want to repeat it? To Mr. Kirby, are there any columns you wish you hadn't written?
There have been columns that the Tribune has wished I hadn't written. In fact, they wouldn't run them. So, some of them will. Some of them will be in the book. In doing humor, specifically religious-oriented humor, you kind of have to make the rules up as you go along because, frankly, and especially with respect to Mormons, there haven't been a lot of trailblazers when it comes to humor. And everybody has their own style and own brand. Yeah, there have been things that I've said that I wish I hadn't said, like beating up President Hinckley. But by and large, no, because I look at it as a learning process. It's kind of funny that most people out there are willing to concede that they can have an individual interpretation of the scriptures, but they want everything they read in a newspaper to be written by the finger of God. And it's kind of, that's really, there's a lot of irony in there.
Yes, she asked if my style included paint or if it was just labels. And initially, it was just labels. And in time, I considered myself a painter, so I was anxious to use the medium. But there's more paper than paint. It's usually used at the end of the process just to bring out the image.
I have a question, and you may not want to answer this. From your professional background, if there is something, you have five different perspectives, if there's something you would like to change or bring to the church because of your professional background, what would it be?
Could I respond to that question in reverse? I think there's something that, there's a tradition that comes from my profession that I would like to take out of the church. And in fact, that I see some considerable indications that the church is attempting to diminish and decrease. And that's the system which has become second nature to most of us in our culture of rights and hierarchies as being individual rights and hierarchies and notions about due process in a legalistic sense being first and foremost. I think, for example, the shift in the church from a church court system to the current non-legalistic, more rehabilitation-oriented system is a very good one in concept. I don't speak to how it's working or how it's being translated at the lower levels of management. But I really believe in that comment in Isaiah, you know, my thoughts are not your thoughts and my ways are not your ways. And I think the notions that we have about individual rights and entitlements have very little to do with the way God intends us to relate to each other as human beings. I think the ethic of care and connectedness, as opposed to ethics of competition and hierarchy and rights, is far more relevant in a religious context.
I'd like to see a question and answer period after each testimony in church.
What I said about development is still an issue for me. I don't know how to make it possible for people to really believe that I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves. That we really are teaching our children that is where that we expect them to go, and that it's obedience to the spirit of their own divine nature that leads them to their own godhood, as opposed to the sense that somehow we're back, sort of what Christina's saying, that the hierarchy is what deems us worthy. And I think there's a certain fear that's inculcated into not believing in the development of individual people that they have within the capacity of themselves to at some point know how to move in that direction. And I don't know how that would necessarily work, but it's the concept of really truly believing that the acorn can be an oak.
Um, just from my personal feelings, and obviously we're all speaking from that, but I think we're all kind of saying the same thing, and that is the sense of, to me, control, and what the definition of art is in terms of the church. And I've sensed frustration with myself in trying to meet their expectations and the general expectation of what the definition is. For example, the church exhibit and the beautiful museum that we see down there, it's a wonderful facility, but there is definitely an agenda attached to that building, and I think what I would like to see is more openness about that discussion, because I certainly have had very spiritual experiences in the things that I paint, even though they may be not as illustrative to and directed to spiritual identity, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But anyway, I think it's the same context in the issue of control and dictation of definition is difficult for me.
I mentioned the way in which we had gathered together a group of bright young historians who contributed wonderful books and articles and speeches on aspects of the church and its history. That group of people, a core of them, are now located as the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute at Brigham Young University. They continue to function, nine of them. And they continue to write books, articles, give speeches, and so on. I hope that that will continue and that their effort to portray honest history will continue.
Could you stand up so people can hear you?
How is your belief in rehabilitation and forgiveness mixed in with victims' rights and just desserts and the decisions that have to make?
Do you want to repeat the question?
I was busy rewriting it so that I could answer it. As I understand the question is, how does a concern for religious values like forgiveness and repentance and the possibility of rehabilitation coincide with the work in a legal system which is designed and created, and this is not part of the question, that's part of the answer, is designed and created for an entirely different purpose. One of the most important ways I deal with that is to acknowledge my limitations. The people of Utah don't pay me to right the wrongs of the world. They pay me to adjudicate disputes, to construe the statutes, to interpret the Constitution, and to resolve and answer the questions that are put to me in my capacity as a judge. And so, to some extent, there is a dichotomy and a need to compartmentalize. But at the same time, there is so much interplay, so much play for policy choices, for identifying the sources that you'll look to for decision making, for defining the outlines of the question that you're going to answer. And I do think that broader concerns enter into that process whenever a judge is attempting to solve problems, whoever the judge is and whatever the judge's values are. So to that extent, I don't think that my belief system is entirely compartmentalized. It is part of my identity and who I am and therefore how I define questions and answer them. For example, though, it's interesting. I mean, I don't take a position on something like the Victims' Rights Bill of Rights, which is now a part of the Utah Constitution by virtue of having been voted into law. I will try to interpret that the way it was written, and I will try to enforce it when I'm asked to. I'll also have to be concerned in that context with other constitutional values that predate it. So I know that's not a very good answer, but the problem is there is no good answer to that question. It's one of those unfathomable things about how we as human beings bring to our processes of daily decision-making all the things that make us who we are. I guess it's kind of like asking Diana why she picks a Campbell soup label or a Morton salt label for a particular value in a particular piece. There are reasons, but I don't know that she could articulate them.
Okay, let's bring the evening to the close. We'll have our duel come up. Is Bernard Silver in the audience? Oh, right here. He'll give our closing prayer, and while we're getting ready to perform as the Tabernacle Choir, I just want to thank the panel again and give them a round of applause.